thank you. Sorry. I call this meeting of the Elections Policy Conference Committee meeting to order. Welcome, members. It's great to be here today. So just to kind of set the lay of the land here, the plan for today, we're going to take public testimony first, and then we will go into recess. We've had some leadership-type meetings over the last few days also, but we want to hear from the public, so we'll take public testimony, then we'll go into a brief recess, I would guess, at least half an hour long, probably a little bit longer, but I would guess not too much longer than that. And then we will come back in and consider adoption of policy provisions. And I should also mention, too, that we have been given permission to negotiate the budget as part of this policy conference committee as well. As often happens, at the end of session, bills are getting rolled together. And also many of the budget provisions are just funding the policy provisions that were being considered. So we will be working within the target that was set for the elections committee's budgets, but we will be discussing those as well as part of this committee. So welcome testimony on budgetary items as well, if anybody has any to give. So with that, did you have any remarks, Chair Carlson?
No, Mr. Chair, I think you've covered everything just about right. Like you've said, we've had some leadership meetings. Not all of our committee members, of course, were not involved in that, so some of this is going to be new to them as well. So that's one of the reasons why we will recess with our particular caucuses, too. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So with that, we will move to public testimony. We don't have a ton of people who signed up, but I'll see if members of the public want to speak also. I think we said about 3 minutes per person, so if you could try to keep it within that, but we won't be too rigid about it at this point. So the first person who signed up is Lily Sass. Sassy, I'm sorry, I always get that wrong. Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Elections Conference Committee. My name is Lily Sassy, and I'm the director of We Choose Us, a coalition of 45 community organizations who represent over 1.5 million Minnesotans across race, class, and zip code. And we are working to build an inclusive multiracial democracy in our state. I want to thank you all for all the work that you have done to not only protect, but also expand access to our democracy this biennium, including but not limited to many of the provisions in front of this conference committee today. I want to speak in favor of a few key provisions. First, the on-campus early voting provision. We have heard from many students who have testified both in committee and outside of this building who need more access to the polls. Students can struggle to find transportation or get time off from class, work, or family obligations on election day. This bill would help remove some of those barriers for many of the 400,000 plus students in Minnesota's higher education system. And most importantly, let students know that young people matter in our democracy too. I also want to explicitly express our support for the inclusion of the Minnesota Voting Rights Act, making Minnesota the only state in the Eighth Circuit, who's standing up to the federal court's devastating rulings on one of the most influential pieces of legislation in our country's history, the Federal Voting Rights Act. This bill says we won't stand for that in Minnesota, and that we're protecting voters, especially black voters and other voters of color, from voter suppression in our state. Lastly, ending prison gerrymandering. For the dignity of human beings and the integrity of our districts, it's important that we recognize people from where they call home, rather than where they're incarcerated. When we think about building a people-centered democracy, these are prime examples of what we mean. That being said, I did want to bring attention to a provision that raised some red flags for us. In line 7.24 to 7.27 of the Senate language, there exists a seemingly small but incredibly impactful inclusion of the words public official in the proposed exception of lobbying rules. By including public officials, the loophole is widened to apply to all officials at any level of government, potentially creating major carve-outs for individuals with exorbitant amounts of positional power, such as executives or CEOs. All too often, our democracy that's supposed to be of, by and for the people, prioritizes the wants and desires of corporations and wealthy special interests. I fear that the addition of this language would do more of the same, and I believe this is a major setback from our Minnesota tradition of increasing transparency in our democracy. I hope you'll sincerely consider this testimony as you move forward in negotiations. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, any member questions or anything? If you wanted to ask questions of any testifier, just raise your hand or grab my attention and we can do that. The second testifier is Kate Klossner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, thank you. For the record, my name is Kate Klossner. I am the legislative chair for the Minnesota Government Relations Council. And if it's okay with you, Nancy and I will just go together and stay to the 3 minutes.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nancy Haas. I'm a lawyer lobbyist with the law firm of Poole Haas and testifying today as president-elect of the Minnesota Government Relations Council, better known as MGRC. MGRC is a nonprofit organization that serves as a trade association of government relations professionals with one common goal, ethical representation at the Capitol. Ethical representation and adherence to the laws governing our community are our core values. For several years, we have worked closely with the Campaign Finance Board on legislation relating to lobbyist registration and public disclosure, as we too share the goal of a transparent and public process. However, our members have been clear. The bill passed last year that expands lobbying registration to all political subdivisions, coupled with the new definition of legislative action, has caused considerable confusion and is overly expansive. Under the new requirements, many professionals, including tribal members, union workers, lawyers, engineers, and nonprofit employees who interact with local and public officials in any way through their normal course of work, would be required to register as lobbyists.
We share the goal of this committee of ensuring that the right people are registered to lobby and also to avoid over-registrations or overwhelming the Campaign Finance Board with erroneous registrations. And so thus we agree with the study language that is proposed in both the House and the Senate. We think that that is a great idea to study who should register and what does define a lobbyist. We also support the Senate language in R54 relating to the expert advice piece to public or local officials at the lobbyist's request. We feel that this is an important provision because it clarifies that subject matter experts and those chemists, those doctors, those actuaries that are brought at the request of a lobbyist, usually accompanied by a lobbyist, to provide highly technical information on their subject matter to both public and local officials, in that act alone are not acting as lobbyists. We do, however, feel that if these professionals, if these experts are advocating on their own, not accompanied or at the request of a lobbyist, then we agree. They should register as lobbyists.
To conclude, I just want to mention, again, we value citizen engagement in the legislative process and are concerned that these regulations may inadvertently dissuade citizens from participating in local and state issues due to confusion about whether or not they need to register as lobbyists. MGRC and the lobbying community we represent are invested in ethical, transparent representation, and we want to ensure clarity and regulations for our community and the general public. MGRC supports the further stakeholder engagement through the study process and using those findings to inform continued clarity on the definition of lobbyist and lobbying registration requirements. Thank you very much for the opportunity to participate today.
Thank you, and I think we may have a question. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate your testimony, and I appreciate the letter that you all sent yesterday. And have been, especially in this conference committee, a little bit in committee, but having a lot of conversations about this provision. I've heard a lot about it. And so I just had a few questions, because when I think about, when we're thinking about lobbying and the lobbying provisions, right, what we are trying to do in balance is really understand from a democracy principle, that it is important that the public, that communities, that constituents understand who is trying to influence government decisions and who's paying for influence of government decisions. If you are a volunteer, if you're a constituent, if you are somebody who's not getting paid to do it, our provision doesn't apply to you. And it is when we talk about the threshold of $3,000 of compensation in the act of trying to influence a decision maker, it's a pretty high threshold for most folks. If you make $100,000 a year, I think it's 60 hours. And if you're doing that much, I think that a voter or maybe a constituent can make the argument, it'd be helpful to know, where you're coming from and what actions you're working on. And with that, this got me thinking about this language a lot from my time on the campaign finance board. But looking at this language, and I'd say both the House and Senate language, digging a little deeper, it feels incredibly broad for the conversation we had in committee, which was really about planning decisions, architects and engineers who may be working directly with staff to get a decision done. That feels very different than, I guess the question I had is, as experts and as folks who are in this space, when we think about the language, providing information, data, advice, professional opinions, direction on the topic, on the individual who has particular expertise through education, professional, occupational training at the request of a lobbyist, that certainly includes that architect, but I also think it probably includes, bringing the CEO of Uber to talk to one of us if it reaches that $3,000 threshold in their expertise. And so I am actually wondering from you all, as we think about this and given your letter, what problem are we trying to solve and who, what class of folks are we trying to solve it with this language? Because I think that will be helpful both as we think about the problem that's been presented and also as we think about the policy that we'll undertake.
Thank you for that question, Chair. Thank you for that question, Representative Freeman. This is something that our organization has worked on over the past few years as we've discussed what defines lobbying, who needs to register with these new registration rules. And what we've heard from our members is that, especially for those of us who are at the Capitol every day, we are professional lobbyists. We register as lobbyists, we report what we work on, we report our hours, all of those things. And we take that very seriously, as you've probably heard. However, we often know a little bit about a lot of things, right? That is our job, is to represent either multiple companies or one company, but all of the issues that come in that company. And so when an issue arises that this legislature is tasked with passing legislation on, oftentimes it really does demand some technical expertise that us as lobbyists just can't provide. Or trust me, if we did provide it, it wouldn't be the best education behind it, right? And so it is helpful for us to then be able to tap an expert. And so, for my example, I work in a lot of environment committees and the transportation committee. It is helpful for me to tap a chemical engineer who can explain exactly what that chemical does and why it's important and how it does all these things in a way that I could never explain it to someone who is then working on a regulation that would possibly alter the way that we use that chemical, right? So it is really helpful. And oftentimes, I think we can all agree that there are bills that aren't just heard once or twice. They are heard multiple times over the course of a session. And these very highly technical experts are often also highly compensated experts because they have that technical expertise and the education that demands it. And so when we're looking at someone who is a doctor or a hospital administrator or that is able to really dial into the policy and give you the technical advice that you need, often it wouldn't take much of them being at the Capitol meeting with each of the legislators that are working on that policy to meet that threshold. And what we like to think of is they would be accompanied. It is my job as the professional lobbyist to meet with you, to make the asks. They are there to simply explain. We are there to follow up, to do the lobbying, and then we report that lobbying throughout. Does that help clarify?
Nancy Haas.
The only thing I was going to add is it sounds like you've given some consideration to perhaps like a planning commission and kind of the process it takes. And it may not surprise you that it's always surprising to me that people don't understand how much our jobs take up here and how many different meetings you have on the same technical issue. And so I would just share that with you from a perspective of it does often take us more time than you might appreciate in terms of, so I look at a planning commission and kind of moving forward that extensive process, very similar to the work that we do here and the amount of time it takes. I just offer that for your consideration as you're thinking through that timepiece.
Senator Westland.
Thank you. I think getting to the heart of this is exactly why we need to have a study. Because one of the questions I have is, it is true that you may have people who provide technical expertise, but my question is, are they providing objective information or are they helping you persuade me on a particular topic for a particular reason? Because as we know, there are always experts who can provide information on two sides of an issue that may be in conflict. And so I think one of the questions that the study has to get to is, so they're providing technical expertise, but it is technical expertise for the purpose of persuading a legislator to a particular conclusion, or is it literally providing, here's the broad range of data and information to help you make a decision? And so we don't want to be overbroad, and we don't want to sweep people up into this who shouldn't be swept into it. And I think we also don't want it to be so narrow and so limited. There are people who are literally engaging in persuasion and being compensated by somebody for it and making sure that we're accounting for that. And that's not clear in my head, and so I'm very glad that we're going to proceed with the study. You know, I think the intention is to remove that one paragraph of language and let the study proceed so that we can have a better sense and be better advised on how to precisely narrowly tailor language to do what we intend to do, and I think what you agree we would like to do. But those are questions for me in my mind. There's a difference between someone providing objective information versus providing persuasive information to help me get to the conclusion requested.
Mr. Chair.
Nancy Haas, sir.
Senator Westland, you raised for me an example of one of my clients, the County Attorneys Association. So I would share with you many of times in our Judiciary Committee meetings, my clients are actually being asked for help from legislators versus I'm here to persuade you. And so what I worry about in this circumstance is all the number of ways that folks come to help and give information to you all that is actually not persuasion, you know, but it's brought at my request to help you all get to where you need to be, that we might catch some folks up who you know, aren't intended. So I just wanted to offer that perspective.
Okay. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that both Ms. Haas and Senator Westland, because I think it gets at the, I think that the challenge and the struggle with this language and with, frankly, this definition that is carving out of who a lobbyist is, because I don't think it is just, I don't think any of us would say that a lobbyist is just sort of the professional lobbyist who does the day in and day out and brings other people in. I think it's really to that point of there are some scientists who may present the facts. There are also scientists who it would be helpful for the public to know if they're spending 60 hours or 40 hours or 30 hours with lawmakers and it affects climate policy, it affects, you know, our health policy, it affects whatever. And so I think, right, this language certainly doesn't distinguish between that. And that is I think, a big concern. I think when we talk about like an expert lobby exemption, we don't want it to be an expert lobby loophole. Because right now it sort of reads as a loophole as, you know, you're an if you're a C-suite or a CEO, you're an expert in your business. And at the request of the lobbyist, you could come in and tell someone why a bill is either good or bad for the business, why a project should be built or not built. All of those things I think currently fit in this language. And what I worry about, and I think we need to be worried about, given where the public is at and what they're You know, you go talk to people and people really have questions about whether it's their voice and there's their decisions, and some of the research bears that out, that are at any level of government the ones driving the show. And I think as policymakers, we need to show and prove that even if you're not up here every day, even if you're just calling your legislator or just a constituent, it's your decisions that are driving the shop. The last thing I will say is, like, I think it is important that this, and I think the way, and I don't think this is the intention, but the way that this is written is the lobbyist can become sort of a cloak or a shield for those other people who actually might be more interesting and might actually show more to the public about what's happening and who's influencing them. So when I think about someone, again, if you make $100,000 a year, 60 hours is a lot. If you make $6 million and you only have an hour, your time is very valuable, but it also means that valuable time you're spending with a legislator means something different. And so I think that, or a governor, or in this case, a mayor or a city planning commission or whatever that decision making is. So I appreciate this. And the last thing I'll just say is I think that as we move forward, and I think we'll sort of probably get some further definition from the campaign finance board and folks, but as we move forward with the study, it is very important that we are grounding this not just in the regulated parties and not just in the folks in this room or in this Capitol, but that we're grounding it in the in ultimately what the goal of these things are, which these rules are, which is ethical representative democracy. And what that means to me is that the people actually believe that the 42,000 or 84,000 folks that that elect us, or the 3-some million that elect the governor and the AG and everyone else, that they're the ones who are making decisions, and they know who else is in the mix. And so with that, I think that I feel like this conversation has been really helpful and good and will drive us forward, and I look forward to that. I think it's really important that study really focuses on the public's right to know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next testifier is Mike Dean. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of North Star Prosperity, and I'm here to advocate for the A24 amendment, which aims to open up campus voting locations. I first want to just thank members for all the work they did last session, and again this session, to really advance voting rights and to also expand voting opportunities for students. This has been some significant changes have happened over the last few years, and it will have a positive impact on opening up democracy for many of our young people. Really throughout the committee hearings, you heard from students who shared their personal perspectives and research on how access to polling locations positively impacts student voting rates. Today, I want to highlight how the status quo is really not working for them as they work to establish on-campus polling locations. Over the last 20 years, I've dedicated myself to addressing this issue. Way back in 2004, I brought a campus polling location to the University of Minnesota at Kauffman Union. Then in 2017, worked with then Joe Mansky in Ramsey County to introduce a pop-up early voting location at St. Paul College. Fast forward to 2022 and 2023, worked at the University of Minnesota to expand our early voting options for them on campus. Both of those efforts, unfortunately, have been unsuccessful. And that really leads me to kind of two perspectives I want to share with the committee. You know, as we kind of look at expanding pop-up locations, there tends to be sort of an inertia that exists among election officials to really expand this type of work. And they often seek refuge in these sort of bureaucratic labyrinths that exist. And despite the historic legislation you all passed last year that opened up early voting pop-up locations, not one new location has been established on a Minnesota college or university over the last 12 months. And I think that really shows the problems with the status quo and really necessitates why the A24 amendment is critical. There are places like the city of Minneapolis does plan to bring forward early campus location at the U of M. But that's not a new location that's existed for a number of years. but it really kind of prompts this one question for me. Why has there not been any progress in expanding polling locations to campuses across the state despite the historic legislation you passed last year? We know that costs really are not a prohibitive factor, but I really want to thank the committee for making it a little bit easier for cities and counties to do this with the budget allocation that you're going to bring forward today. And so in closing, I want to urge you to adopt the A24 amendment because it will establish a clear process for students to expand those voter access and address the barriers that prevent young people from exercising their right to vote. I hope also in future years we'll continue to address this and expand it to more campuses because right now you're limited to just residential institutions, and that leaves out a huge chunk of students, mainly community colleges, who would be most positively impacted by this issue, particularly because they have lower voting rates than students at universities. It's about a 15-point sort of difference between a university student and a community college student. And I know this legislation, if expanded to them, would have a great impact on really improving those voting rates on our community colleges to BIPOC and low-income communities. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay. Next testifier is Wintana Malikan. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, y'all. My name is Wintana Malikan, and I am happy to be here. First, I just want to say I really appreciate all of the work that you have done around elections reform. That has been the issue that I have been working on for the last decade as the co-chair of the Restore the Vote Coalition. And I just personally want to thank you for the work that you've done around prison gerrymandering. For the last decade, I've been hearing from folks incarcerated and released how disappointed they were to be not counted in the communities that they're from, but in the places that they're held. And so I'm very happy that you're in alignment about that. And also support youth voting, providing that access on the college campuses. Lots of young people want to be able to cast their ballot where they live, so I hope that is prioritized. But I specifically want to talk about this expert lobbying loophole. As someone who has worked on a lot of public policy, I am very upset that there is the chance that we could be creating a carve-out for specific people to have extra access to our elected leaders, our public servants, that I know community members won't have that same access to. And creating this carve-out allows for that information to not be documented, to have no record of it. What is to stop some CEO from having a two-day conference with someone? And we will never know that this conversation happened. We'll never know what deals were made. And, of course, this information doesn't get documented to the point that we know what they discussed. But I want to know who is having these conversations and who are they having them on the behalf of. Because everyday working class people who work at McDonald's, who work at Burger King, who are showing up here asking for minimum wage are not going to get that same access. And they should be able to tell what CEO was coming here to get a private meeting with whatever elected official. So I'll pause there.
Any questions? Okay. Don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Matt Hilgert. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Matt Hilgert. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. The Association of Minnesota Counties represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I'm also here today testifying on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities and Minnesota Association of County Officers. I want to talk about three issues today in the bill, and I'll start with post-secondary pop-up locations. I did have some scripted remarks that were mostly complimentary in nature in terms of the amendment that was for consideration, but I do think it's worthwhile to pause after prior testimony and some insinuations that were made regarding what election administrators put up as bureaucracy for preventing these locations from going up. You did just give us permission to do pop-ups last year. And I did think the testifier made a good remark in terms of the substantial election changes that we made last year, especially in regards to early voting. We were there as your partner to help you with that. We've been there as your partner to implement it. We have constraints amongst our election workforce. And if any of you have talked to your cities or counties, it's one of the toughest fields that we're finding to staff. You've done tremendous work to support us in trying to prevent that. You've increased voter funds. You've done the election interference work on this committee, and we thank you for that. But to insinuate that we're putting up bureaucratic red tape or otherwise to prevent polling locations, I think is inappropriate, and it's something that I don't think our election administrators would respect. This is the first election that we will have after the pop-up law has been put into place. The first general election will be happening this November. We had requested in prior conversations that we let that play out to see how this would work, if pop-ups would be utilized. We have expressed concerns about costs, about limited capacity and potential shifts in our resources if we were have to do pop-ups. And I think the third thing is just a consideration for the committee in terms of precedent of what this means as we continue to potentially expand 203B. All that said, I want to appreciate the A4 as well. And that was what I was planning to remark prior to the testimony, and that is the considerations and thoughtful considerations that you put in to trying to address some of our concerns. And I want to thank you for that very sincerely. The items that you put in there were, I think, thoughtful and will help us as we get these requests and try to deal with our limited resources that we have in managing elections. So thank you. Moving on to item number 2, which is the VRA, the Voting Rights Act. I think it's impressive that in 3 months, Minnesota has put together a Voting Rights Act in response to the Eighth Circuit, I believe it is, or yeah, I'm saying that right, I'm not an attorney. When we were first communicated with by, I think it was Representative Greenman back in November, she said this was going to be a lot of work, but we needed to get this done. And I just appreciate the collaboration, the spirit of collaboration that you had. We had several meetings with legislators, frankly, most of the beginning meetings just to educate us on the federal voting or the new Voting Rights Act as it was different from the federal VRA. And I appreciate that. I appreciate the thoughtfulness of the legislators in that task, as well as the Secretary of State's office, both Ms. Freeman, Ms. Strother, and Mr. Erickson, who was their attorney and counsel in that staff and provided us with additional information. The changes that were made in the pre-suit notice section that are included in the A43 amendment, we are very supportive of those changes that were made. We did have some concerns about the pre-suit notice. At one point, we were saying that we would be okay if that was not included in the bill. Representative Greenman met with stakeholders that included the League of Minnesota Cities, Minnesota Association of County Officers, and AMC, and worked with us alongside staff to address some of our concerns. And the language in there, specifically starting on page 7, helps us with that kind of definition of good faith. And frankly allows us not to have to respond to things that we actually didn't think we did wrong. So that will help. It still keeps the good faith intention, but I think it provides some guardrails for us to respond to requests. There is also the cost remedies, and then there is on line 8.2 to 8.4, when we actually say, yes, we will solve this. We'll put up a polling location here to address your concerns and make sure that that isn't an omission of liability that could be used in the future in court. So I really do appreciate those changes. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for your work on that, and others in the Senate for your work on that piece, too. And I'll pause with, and I'll finalize my testimony with one thing, and I hope you'll give me the latitude because it's a compliment, and that is, if you do have the budget bill in front of you, you've done fantastic work as a committee the last 2 years to increase the visibility of what election administrators do, the stresses they see, the limited resources they have, and the core fact that we do not believe we should be running elections administrations dependent on a property tax base wealth. That is to say, we are primarily funding our election administration duties based on our levy capacity, and not every single community has the same levy capacity. And the symbolic nature of the voter fund is to say the state has a role. This is a vital duty that you are doing, and we want to be there to help you. You started that last year. You're hopefully, via amendments later in this committee or if you take on the budget, adding to that. And we'd like to continue working with you in the future to point out the need to this. I think it would be a great OLA report or study to actually do an objective analysis about how much election administrators and entities are spending in elections, absent the state and federal funding, what's falling back to the levy. But it's certainly something us as an association, AMC, is willing to also do on our own. So thank you very much for the latitude and time today, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all.
Thank you, and I think Representative Greenman may have a question for you or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's actually more of a comment, both to you, I see Troy in the room, Brooke and Alex before, but you all, I have done this work a lot with local elections infrastructure around the country. And I will say in Minnesota, sometimes we are in tension, but we are always communicating. And the work that that you all have been willing to do, Michael Stahlberger and others at MACO, to really help us and help in partnership figure out how we can make both more inclusive and expansive and also just stronger and more secure elections. I think over the last couple of years and especially this year, and I know whether it's the Voting Rights Act, the campus voting provision, and the Voter Act Fund, all of those things I think we've done in deep communication and partnership, and I just want to recognize and thank you for that and look forward to that. And then as you talk about, and I think one thing we don't tout enough, and I say this to us on this committee because we did it last year and I think there's more work to do, is this treating elections, the basic infrastructure of our elections as infrastructure, and as infrastructure that is, when we think about the other things we fund in every corner of this state and how we support it in perpetuity, that is also this. And as, you know, the six of us election nerds over here, it is sort of our job to bring that back to the public and our caucus and our constituents. So I appreciate your partnership in that and all the work that went into to this bill this year. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Westland.
It's the Representative Greenman and Senator Westland show today, I guess. just a couple of comments. So last year we did pass language about the pop-up locations, and it is may versus must. So election administrators have the ability to create pop-ups should they choose to do so. And so this is just simply saying that if the students or the school request a pop-up location there, that pop-up location should be provided, but it should also be noted that that location is available to the general public. And so some of these locations on a school campus are going to serve not just the students who are there, but the community there, like any other pop-up location. And so, we're providing a little money. And we do understand the challenges that our election officials face, but I do think it's important that the student populations in particular have some unique needs in the same way that folks in healthcare facilities or veterans' homes and so forth, you know, we do provide services to them in terms of election officials providing absentee ballots. And so it just seems to me that really what this is about is making sure that we are creating an election process that is inclusive, that makes it easier for some folks to vote who may have a little bit more difficult time to vote by virtue of the fact that they're a student located somewhere where getting to a different polling place may be difficult. So the way I'm reading the language, it says the based on the May from last year, a county could certainly just say, we are going to do a pop-up location at the school. That's our pop-up location. I don't think, my understanding of the language is, I don't think the county would be required to do any other pop-up locations. Those are all, under this statute, those are all allowed but not required. So I appreciate the challenges our election officials face. We're doing everything that we can, but really our intention is to make sure that we are looking at populations that continue to have difficulties voting and trying to remove some of those barriers.
Thank you. Thank you. Next is Emma Rage. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Emma Rage, and I'm the Policy and Civic Engagement Manager at Common Cause Minnesota. Common Cause Minnesota is a nonpartisan grassroots citizens lobby home to over 18,000 statewide multipartisan members. And despite belonging to various Minnesota party affiliations or not being affiliated, the one thing they've come together to do is support our work in ensuring that our republic's democracy is safeguarded and everyone's vote counts. I'm here today to testify on behalf of Common Cause Minnesota in support of provisions allowing for temporary one-day on-campus polling locations, ending the practice of prison gerrymandering, the changes made to the deepfake provisions, and to state our support and recommend additional considerations for the Minnesota Voting Rights Act. We are so glad to see that the Elections Omnibus Bill includes language for ending the practice of prison gerrymandering, establishes a Voting Rights Act, and has an amendment to adopt the language regarding one-day on-campus polling locations. We are also glad to see the amendment regarding deepfake provisions. Opening on-campus polling places has proven to advance voter accessibility for students who are eligible to vote. Adding temporary polling places on college campuses is a step toward co-creating a more inclusive democracy while uplifting the voices of young people in our civic process. We know that Minnesota's BIPOC students face unique difficulties in getting to the polls, as is evident in voter turnout disparities for this group. Opening one-day on-campus polling locations may be a way to narrow that gap and create greater parity among young voters. We also urge the committee to include language that will enable one-day polling locations for our community colleges. Ending prison gerrymandering stops the practice of using incarcerated individuals to artificially inflate local political power via the census. Prison gerrymandering creates an inaccurate representation of the local community where the prison is located and diminishes an accurate reflection of incarcerated persons in their home communities. To achieve fair and accurate representation for all Minnesotans, we must ensure that the practice of prison gerrymandering comes to an end. The Minnesota Voting Rights Act will guarantee voters the right to sue if they face voter suppression or vote dilution and provides for reimbursement of attorney fees for the prevailing party at the court, at the discretion of the court. It is critical that we respond to the dilution of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 by moving state law that minimally addresses this aspect of protection. We urge the committee to make the language and structure of these provisions as approachable as possible for disenfranchised voters, particularly those without the assistance of legal counsel. We recommend the adoption of the language in the Senate side, Section 200.4, Subdivision 1, as the structure of the language is easier to grasp for voters who may need to reference this language when thinking about pursuing legal action. Common Cause Minnesota continues to strongly recommend the inclusion of provisions allowing for the creation of a statewide database that would act as a repository for election and demographic data with the goal of ensuring transparent and evidence-based practices in election administration. The changes to the provisions regarding deepfakes addresses the need to ensure the intent of holding bad actors accountable and minimizing the unintended effect of penalizing individuals who may be unintentionally engaging in deepfake content. Thank you for your work and keeping Minnesota centered in this process, and thank you for considering the recommendations I've outlined today.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, that is all the people who have signed. Oh, Senator Bolden, do you have a question for Emma Rage? Okay, I was going to ask, this might get to your question. Why don't you just ask your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologies for jumping in. I have a question for, I'm wondering, I see Jeff Sigurdsson here from the Campaign Finance Board. I wondered if he would be willing to come forward and answer a question.
But yes.
Whenever the time is appropriate.
Sure. Actually, let me just ask if there are any members of the public who wish to testify first who did not sign up. Okay. I don't see any, so that was actually going to be my next order of business. So welcome to the committee, Director Sigurdsson. If you... maybe just proceed with your testimony or your question, Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson, for coming forward. I have a question around a provision that we had a bit of conversation about earlier, which I appreciate that conversation. In the Senate language, it is line 7.24 to 7.27, the piece about the lobbying potential loophole there. And I just want to sort of get my arms around what that would include or not include. We, as I said, we had that good discussion earlier. So in testimony, there were some concerns raised. We've got letters that have some concerns raised. So I want to just try to wrap my arms around what that means. So I'm going to give an example and would like your help to sort of walk through your perspective of would that sort of meet this definition or not. I use an example just from my own district. So say there was a healthcare-related bill, and a lobbyist is working on that, and they bring in, for example, the CEO of, let's say, Mayo Clinic for my district to speak with the governor or a legislator about that bill. Would that be carved out with this language?
Director Sigurdsson. I guess maybe identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the executive director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Senator Bolden, I believe that that would be covered by the exception here, assuming that the CEO is appearing at the lobbyist request to provide information on the medical issue or the medical development that they're interested in. I think it would be not a stretch to say that if you're a CEO of a medical company, you would have the sort of expertise that would be covered by this provision.
Senator Bolden?
Thank you. I appreciate that. So that raises some concerns for me, I will say. And I appreciate that, again, trying to sort of get our arms around what this would mean in real life and real practice. And I think, again, just to briefly reiterate, I think there is potentially, you know, there's an issue that was brought that this was intended to solve. But I think this language is pretty broad and sort of casts a wide net that maybe you know, includes other folks that we weren't intending to. So I am grateful for the study that we'll move forward to really take a look at, because we should have careful language because it really is a democracy issue. And you know, citizens, voters, Minnesotans should know who is, you know, being paid and earning money to influence folks. And so looking forward to continuing that work. And to be sure we get the language right to really do what we are trying to do. So thank you for helping me understand that.
Thank you. Representative Vernig.
Thank you, Chair. I also have a similar question in the same vein. If you look at more of a local level, in conference committee, we heard more about like planning and land use, and it seems like there might be some broader implications. How would this play out? So, in my district, we have a large training facility. If we were looking at, you know, adding a stadium of some sort or things like that with the local city planning commission or the city council, how would that section, the part 10 there, same in the Senate language, 7.24, how would that play out in this situation?
Director Sigurdsson, if you could speak up a bit, too, I think that might be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vernick, assuming that the lobbyist has asked an expert to come in on the impact on building the facility, then if that expert provided what they would say would be the best option, in some cases in land use, there's questions of what's the best civil engineering approach to developing sewer and water lines for development, for example. And if they were to say that you should take option one as opposed to option two, that would not, under this provision, I believe in both the House and the Senate language, that would not be viewed as lobbying because they would be at the request of a lobbyist providing that information to the City Council or the Planning Commission.
Representative Vernig?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any additional questions for Director Sigurdsson? Anyone else, any members of the conference committee would like to call up for a question? I know the Office of the Secretary of State is here. Okay, all right, I think we're covered then with the testimony portion here. So we will go into a brief recess, as I mentioned at the outset. I think I would estimate it would be at least half an hour. I would hope not too much more than that, but so we can meet kind of as chairs to talk about some of this, and then potentially separately as our House caucus and then the Senate caucus as well. I guess stay tuned. When you see us coming back into the room, I think that should be a tip off that we're about to start up again. So any other?
We'll send a notice.
Oh yeah, and we will put it on the listserv that we are reconvening also, maybe like 5 or 10 minutes before that happens or something like that. Okay. All right, so with that, we are in recess. I call the meeting of the Elections Conference Committee back to order. Thank you for your patience. We had some good meetings as separate caucuses, and then the chairs and staff met, and I think we have reached agreement on major provisions. So we will have our nonpartisan staff kind of go through that. There are a couple different spreadsheets. There's one spreadsheet, time-stamped 1:40 p.m. that includes the policy, well, the various provisions we'll be going through and adopting. Budget is at the end, so we'll have staff go through each of these documents probably in the order they appear on this spreadsheet. And then when we get to the budget item, we will have our fiscal staff go through the budget spreadsheet as well, so everyone's aware of what's in there. So I will just give them a moment to get set up here. And I guess if you just want to identify yourselves for the record, that would be helpful when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, I'm Matt Garing from House Research.
Mr. Chair, Lexi Stengel, Senate Counsel.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I think what we'll do to guide you through this chart is just to go row by row based on line number. And this is the document that's been posted that includes both the summary description that we used when we did the walkthrough of the side-by-side. And there's now a new column that says proposed action. And so we'll kind of prompt you to each of those motions as we go through. Some of those rows have been previously adopted by the conference committee, so we're just going to highlight the
Can you
motions.
Maybe move your mic a little closer, Mr. Garrett?
Yes. Sorry. We'll go through the chart using the proposed action column, and we'll highlight the sections to be adopted and where there are amendments or oral amendments to be adopted that would be incorporated within those sections. So then, Mr. Chair, the first row on the proposed action chart is row one, the local government .gov domains. The proposal here is to adopt Senate sections 3 and 91 with one oral amendment on line 57.3 of the Senate language, delete elections shall and insert absentee voting must.
Okay. Is it sufficient for me just to say so moved? Okay, so moved. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion prevails.
And then the next row, row two, relates to school board vacancies. The proposal here is to adopt House Section 1 with the following amendment on line 2.22 after the period, insert, this paragraph does not apply if the vacancy occurs after candidate filing begins pursuant to Section 205A.06 in the year preceding the end of the term.
Okay. Any discussion to that motion? I will move it. So moved. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails.
And then row three, as you see on the chart, was previously adopted by the conference committee. That is true of row four and five on page two also. And row six, these are the miscellaneous election administration provisions that were previously adopted. There is one motion here to reconsider language related to the American Translator Association that was previously adopted by the conference committee. So the motion, Mr. Chair, would be to amend House Line 25.24 after must insert use the American Translator Association or employed by the Office of Enterprise Translation established in Section 16B.373 or must.
Okay, I'll move reconsideration of the previously adopted language with the amendment that's mentioned in the spreadsheet. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion is adopted.
And then, Mr. Chair, row 7 and 8 are previously adopted by the conference committee. Row 9 also was previously adopted by the conference committee.
On row 10, the proposal is to adopt House Section 14 with the amendment on House Line 16.21 after sufficient, insert the phrase, for the county auditor.
Okay, so moved. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Line 11, the proposal is to adopt Senate Section 24.
Okay. So moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
On line 12, this is the temporary polling place on post-secondary institutions, and the proposal is to adopt the A24 amendment, which is in packets.
Okay. I think Senator Bolden was going to move the A24 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would offer the A24 amendment.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
On the next page, on line 13, the proposal is to adopt Senate Section 37.
Okay. So moved. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
On line 14, relating to presidential electors, the proposal is to adopt House Section 52 with the amendment as follows. On House Line 40.14, after the period, insert the following sentence. The governor must alert the members of the Capitol Press Corps of the location where the electors will meet.
Okay. So moved. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
On line 15, related to presidential elector contests, the motion is to adopt the Senate sections.
Okay, so moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
On row 16, the proposal is to adopt the Senate sections with the following changes. on page R43, on Senate page 52, line 30, before the word sell, insert personal, and to make the same change on R48, Senate line, page 57, line 15, so it refers to a personal cell phone.
Okay. So moved. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
On line 17, the proposal is to accept the House position.
Okay, so moved. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
On line 18, relating to deepfakes, the proposal is to adopt House sections 55, 56, 63, 64, and the amendment, the House Amendment A52, which is in packets.
Okay. I think Senator Westland was going to move this one.
So moved.
Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair, to be clear, was that just the A52 amendment, or was that to move the sections as well?
I think that was all of that, unless staff feels that was not sufficient.
Just making sure everybody was, I think okay. It was sufficient to move everything, just making sure everybody was on the same page.
Okay.
And then on line 19, relating to the restoration of voting rights notice, the proposal is to adopt Senate section 87 and the portion of Senate section 102 that repeals section 243.205.
Okay, so moved. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chair, row 20 is the language that relates to the county sheriff and county attorney vacancies. So the proposal here is to adopt Senate sections 88 and 89.
Okay, so moved. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then, Mr. Chair, lastly, within this article is the repealer related to the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners, which was previously adopted by the conference committee, so no action is needed there. The next category in this chart is the Minnesota Voting Rights Act, and there's one amendment that covers most of this language. This is the H4772A43 amendment.
Okay. Representative Greenman, I think, was going to move the A43.
I would move the A43 and just note that it reflects most of the language. It was in both of the side-by-sides, but we did it as a DE because we thought that was cleaner.
Okay. So the A43 has been moved. Is there any additional discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then, Mr. Chair, there's one more section related to the Voting Rights Act, the A55 amendment. This is the section that inserts the policy related to the Voting Rights Act cost-sharing account. So the appropriations will appear in the separate amendment that has the spreadsheet and money in it. This is the policy that creates the account that allows the money to be spent.
Okay. I believe Representative Greenman was going to move this.
I would move the, what number is it?
55.
The A55, and just note that this was the language that was passed in the elections budget bill, setting up the account.
Okay. The A55 has been moved. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then, Mr. Chair, we move into the campaign finance provisions of the bill. Row 36 is the campaign finance provisions impacting local candidates and campaigns. The proposal here is to accept Senate sections 71, 72, 73, 74, 75, 76, 77, 78, 79, 80, 81, and 102, the repealers that affect Chapter 211A, and also Senate sections 4, 5, and 10. And then within this motion, you'd also be agreeing to adopt a January 1st, 2025 effective date for each section.
Okay, so I will make that motion. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then next, Mr. Chair, row 37 is the electioneering communications language. This is all contained in Amendment A57.
Okay, I believe Representative Greenman was going to move.
I would move the A57.
Okay, any discussion? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then row 38 is the lobbying provisions that relate to lobbying of political subdivisions. The proposal here is to accept House Sections 1, 2, and 3 with the exclusion in House Section 2 of lines 49.28 to 49.31.
Okay, I will make that motion. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then row 39 was a Senate-only section related to principal reporting requirements. This proposal here is to adopt Senate Section 9.
Okay, I will make that motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Motion. No discussion.
Discussion? Let's do that again. So, any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Sorry.
It's okay. No, keep me honest.
On line 40, relating to campaign finance penalties, the proposal is to adopt Senate Sections 11 and 17.
Okay, I will make that motion. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
On line 41, related to state and local lobbying activity study, the proposal is to adopt the A54 amendment.
Okay, I think Representative Vernig was going to make that motion.
Yeah, I'd like to move the A54, please.
Okay, any discussion? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
On line 42, related to census worker access, that was previously adopted, so no action is required. On line 43, related to incarcerated persons redistricting, the proposal is to adopt House Section 2 and Senate Sections 86 and 98.
Okay, I will make that motion. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair, that takes us into some additional sections to be considered by the Conference Committee. On line 43 through 46, there are four items that we can walk through in a little more detail, and they are all contained in the A25 amendment.
Okay, so Chair Carlson, I believe you were going to move the A25 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the A25 amendment.
Okay, it's been moved. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the next row is row 47. This is language related to electronic databases of notaries and modifications related to the notary stamp. This is Amendment A48.
Okay, this is the A48 amendment. I believe, Senator Westland, you were going to move this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A48 amendment. Again, this has to do with notaries. Probably the most important part of this amendment is the fact that any stamp that complies currently will not have to be renewed or changed until after the term, when it will then have our new state seal on it.
Correct. I would also add that, I carried this bill, and it becomes important as of tomorrow, because we will have a new state seal officially as of tomorrow. So thank you for that motion. Any additional discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair, row 48 reflects an amendment to A56 that adopts several amendments that were adopted to the House Elections Finance Bill on the House floor. This includes a requirement that the Secretary of State use the Social Security Death Index for updating voter registrations. It requires candidates to present a proof of residence when filing for office, and it prohibits candidates from making a personal loan to their campaign with terms that would require the campaign to pay back interest on that loan. So this is the A56 amendment, and there's also an oral amendment that Ms. Dangle can describe.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, the oral amendment, there are two pieces to the oral amendment. The first piece is on page 1, line 19. After the word candidates, insert current, so it reads candidates current address. And the second piece is on page 2, line 2, after the period, insert the sentence, if the address on the affidavit and the documentation do not match, comma, the filing officer must not accept the affidavit. I'll read that again. If the address on the affidavit and the documentation do not match, comma, the filing officer must not accept the affidavit.
Okay, thank you. And so I'm going to make this motion. Is it sufficient if I move the A56 with the incorporation of the oral amendment? Okay, I will make that motion. And just for the record, these three provisions reflect amendments that were offered by GOP members during the House floor debate on the budget bill. I thought they had some really good ideas, so I'm glad we were able to incorporate them. I don't know whether that will be enough to give this bill bipartisan vote in support. I certainly hope so, but regardless, I think these were good ideas incorporated on the floor, and I appreciate the willingness of the conference committee to adopt them. So any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then, Mr. Chair, the last row on this chart is the A27 amendment. This relates to the appropriations and the spreadsheet, so I may defer to Mr. Erickson and Ms. Roberts to walk through the detail there if you'd like.
Sure. The fiscal staff could go through the details, that'd be great.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There should be a spreadsheet timestamped May 10th at 1:31 p.m. in your packets reflecting a conference agreement on how to spend the election's target. Lines 8 and 9 are ending the base for the voting equipment grant account and Dropbox grant base. The amounts that we're going for those grant programs is being repurposed for an increase in the transfer to the voter account, the Voting Operations Technology and Election Resources account created in last year's bill. That's on line 6, where you'll see that $1.75 million carrying across all fiscal years. There's additionally an extra $86,000 in fiscal year 25. On line 7, you will see $200,000 in fiscal year 25 for college campus polling location reimbursements, which provides the funding for the policy that Mr. Gehring described in the A24. The funding for that in the tails is $40,000 for fiscal year 26 and all other even-numbered fiscal years, and $110,000 in fiscal year 27 and odd-numbered fiscal years. Then on line 12, you'll see there is a transfer into the Voting Rights Act cost-sharing account that Mr. Gehring described in the A55. It's a special revenue account that is set up as a cost-sharing account for claims arising out of the VRA. That is $144,000 in fiscal year 25 and then $25,000 each year ongoing. And then finally, on lines 15 and 16 are two one-time appropriations to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, $20,000 for the candidate finance reporting requirements of Article 4, and then a $50,000 one-time for campaign treasurer online training development. And then you'll see down on the bottom on line 34 that meets the committee's target of $500,000 in the current biennium and $200,000 in the tails.
Okay, thank you. And Willip, just to get the motion before us, Chair Carlson was going to make the motion. Is it just sufficient to move the A27 amendment, or should we incorporate the spreadsheet in that too?
Mr. Chair, the numbers in the spreadsheet are incorporated in the A27, so you can just move the A27.
Okay. Sure. Then Chair
move the A27 amendment.
Okay, thank you. Chair Carlson has moved the A27 amendment, which incorporates the budget. Is there any discussion to this? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chair, that's the last item on the chart. So unless the conference committee has other items that they'd like to have included, the next step would be to adopt a motion that directs staff to prepare a conference report that reflects the action of the conference committee, and then also authorize staff to make technical and conforming changes necessary to reflect the conference committee's intent.
Sure. So I will motion for nonpartisan in the revisor's office to prepare the elections conference committee report with the direction that staff make any technical corrections as necessary. That's a sufficient motion?
Yep.
Okay, any discussion to that? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. I think maybe that's it. So thank you so much to our staff in particular for staying up at long hours to put this together. We would not be able to do this without you. Thank you to all the conferees. I think this has been a good experience. Does anybody have any closing remarks or anything you'd like to say? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say that we are probably the best conference committee, looking around, nodding agreement. So I don't know if I can make a motion on that, but thank you both for chairing it.
Chair Carlson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have to say that this is the best I've ever encountered as well. But I want to thank the staff who has worked so hard on getting this done, and especially the financial people, because we stayed within our target. So this is something where I don't know if everyone else, all the other committees are going to stay within their targets, but we did.
Yeah, we didn't have a huge target, so it would have been very, very easy to have gone over. So thank you. Okay, well, with that, there's no other business. I guess stay tuned for the next steps in this when we get the report, members of the committee. But seeing with no further business before us, we are adjourned.